Norwich 7, Reading 1. No, you're not hearing things. Norwich 7, Reading 1.
S-E-V-E-N.
Indeed. As my co-host, Mr. Dave Harris, has just spelled out for you, it wasn't a good weekend for Reading on the pitch, as we got a royal thumping at Carrow Road. We'll do our best to try and figure out why it's happened, whether we should be really scared going forward, or whether it's just one of those weekends. But amidst that gloom on the pitch, there's goodness off it, as the takeover moves one step closer with EFL conditional approval for our Chinese takeover. Again, we'll look at whether this is good news, bad news, and whether there's a sting in the tail of this whole scenario. All of that and much, much more coming up on the Tylersen Podcast, episode number 125. My name is Dan Wimbush, editor of thetylersen.com. And thank you very much, as always, for taking the time to download and listen to the show. Before we delve into all of those tasty stories, just a very quick thank you to everyone who's joined into the Patreon campaign at patreon.com/thetylersen. It's our crowdfunding campaign. If you like what we do here and you want to see us get bigger and better, as we've hopefully done and shown with things like the YouTube channel and this very show, why not put your hand in your pocket and give that a little bit extra, as Pervy Wink has done, a regular contributor into the show. He's always in the mailbag, and now he's put his hand in his pocket. So thank you very much indeed for your donation. To everybody else who continues to give, it is very, very much appreciated. Anyway, I mentioned him earlier. Dave, you're with me today. How are you?
Struggling a little bit, yeah. Came out of nowhere, that defeat, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't think we exactly saw it coming. I don't think anybody in the Prediction League even predicted a defeat, yet alone a 7-1.
Quite.
So, yeah, we'll have to see how that goes. But as I said, only one guest with us today. Funnily enough, everyone's gone to ground, Dave, after a 7-1 defeat. No Johnny, no Steve, no mm-hmm. Rob, no one.
Yeah.
It's just us. We'll have to gamely battle through.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll keep the where am I going?
The positivity going.
That'll do. Yes.
Yeah. We'll get a positive game.
Looking for something to say, and there's nothing to say.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kind of like what Yapstown must have said at full time. Anyway, on that note, let's get into it. Let's get it over with. Norwich 7, Reading 1. Let's get into the recap.
Recapping this week's Championship action.
Dave, I hosted a post show up on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Tylersen, get that plug in nice and early, with Ollie minutes after the full-time whistle.
I listened to about 2 minutes of it and I couldn't take any more.
Yeah, because of the subject matter, not because of us, right?
Because of the subject matter.
Yeah, good save. Awesome. Good save, I like that. No, I'll slide that fiver across the table.
Thanks. That's my comment.
And right. As you might have told from those 2 minutes, it was tough to know what to say in the immediate aftermath, because we've had these massive beatings before, but they've never really been so out of the blue as this one. Or was this even out of the blue? Was this we said earlier it was a bit of a surprise defeat, but should we have been surprised given some of the away form that we've had this season?
I think there's always a key element of surprise with the level of the defeat. You know, conceding seven goals in a game, you've not done very well. But at the same time, you know, we've suffered some really quite heavy defeats this season: Newcastle, Brentford, Fulham, and even 3-0 defeats at the likes of Preston,
Brighton.
Good sides have put us to the sword, some more than others. But you know, particularly away from home, we concede a lot of goals. We concede a lot of chances. So could we really, after how many games is it now? 20 away from home now. 3 games to go, having conceded 42 goals, can we really turn around and say, having already suffered 3 heavy defeats, that this is a surprise? 7 goals, yes, not good. But the manner of the defeat and the fact that we've conceded 6.5.
Absolutely. I think we're down to the third worst away record in terms of conceding goals in the division, funnily enough, by Norwich.
Rotherham and Norwich.
Yeah, and Rotherham, who are on a course for a historic low second-tier points total as well, so there's no glory to be held there.
They'll go and beat us now, won't they?
we'll come on to that later in any other business. But conceding 30 shots as well, 13 on target, just... That's a shot. And considering we won the possession battle again, I think we had, 58 or 59% of the possession? So Norwich, with their 40-odd percent, are managing just shot after shot. So if you presume that they have the ball, say the ball's in play for, 60, 70 minutes?
That's a shot
every minute,
every three minutes.
No, not even that, because if you think about it, I always used to remember on the Sky Sports, back in the day, they used to do amount of time the ball was in play. Mm-hmm. And it always used to be about
60,
70 minutes. So they've had just under half of that, say 30 minutes. So they're averaging a shot a minute.
Yeah.
I'm at a loss to explain how it happened. Now, one mitigating factor you can say is that this squad is dealing with a lot of injuries at the moment. You may look at that first 11 and go, okay, there's a lot of good established names, but look at the players that are missing at the moment. Now, at the weekend, Paul McShane still missing, no Joey Vandenberg, no Roy Behrens, Thiago Alori not in the squad either. Jordan Abita and Danny Williams on the bench, presumably because they're not fully fit either. No George Evans, Stephen Quinn still missing, Callum Harriott's missing. There is a lot of players and trusted Stan players as well that weren't able to line up on Saturday. Is that any sort of excuse or reason to explain such an abhorrent display?
I don't think it can be excused. It's a possible reason, but at the same time, they're still shown that they are accomplished players. But they've been somewhat shown up at Carrow Road. I'd quite happily turn around and say, yeah, it's not an excuse, but you can explain it to a degree.
A lot of frustration shown towards the lone players in particular. Not so much Reece Oxford, but more Jordan Much and Lewis Grab. And a lot of fans now, certainly the more vocal fans anyway, turning their ire to them, sort of saying, well, this is what went wrong last year. Why are you doing this again, Yap? I remember specifically Tiger saying that they were trying to move away from lone players when he met the fans in the pre-season.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, I mean, is it too simplistic just to say, well, the lone players, they're not putting in as much effort? They don't care as much.
No. No, quite frankly. Jordan Much, I don't think, offers as much quality as some of the permanent players here. Lewis Grabin, I think, is being played out of position. I think he's a central striker.
Agreed.
He's certainly not a wide player. And he's looking lost out there, hence the reason why he's looking... you can perceive it as disinterested. Perhaps he's fed up of playing wide. He doesn't want to play wide. A player can easily get disheartened with that. I don't believe that he's putting in, based on what I've seen, any loss of effort. I think he's just a victim, shall we say, of being played out of position. He's a central striker.
Yeah, I could excuse Grabban a lot more than Much. I thought Much was absolutely appalling. And Vicky, who did our player ratings up on the thetylerson.com, you can go and read them up there, gave him a zero. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost... I remember when you did player rankings once, you did... Did you give Pavel Pogrebniak a one
in the
Bournemouth game?
Yes, Bournemouth. Yeah, for his 7-minute cameo when he just ran around holding his hand after he supposedly hurt it in the first 30 seconds.
So that performance was better than Much's on Saturday. He was hauled off after, about 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You look at those goals back, those six first-half goals, and the amount of times you see Much slowly jogging or not putting a foot in, it's so frustrating. So frustrating. Now, we did have warnings of this when he arrived at the club. I remember we got the opinion of a Crystal Palace fan.
We did.
And they said that the worrying thing for them was they couldn't tell you what Jordan Much was good at.
Yeah.
And so far, I've got nothing. I can only agree with them because I don't know what he's bringing. He's not putting foot in and being a strong player. He's not spraying the ball around. He's not even particularly energetic in a Jem Karachan sense of, you know, hassling and harrying. He's just kind of there. I mean, he's not awful at anything in particular, but what is he adding?
Yeah, it's a, you can't really... Not a huge amount of anything that is particularly... that sort of he's expert at. You know, you can only agree with that article that the Palace fans put up. I'm sure there are clubs of, fans of other clubs that would agree, namely Cardiff. Cardiff fans actually quite liked him. But, you know, ever since he's arrived, he's a bit of a slow start. Do you think? I was thinking, you know,
well, he got that goal on his debut against
Ipswich. Give him time, but he's not actually pushed on. And certainly, as soon as the chips were down on Saturday, he's one of those players that went missing. And if Stam's hauled him off after 50 minutes, there's obviously a reason for that. He's only done it 50 minutes on two or three occasions. He hauled Liam Kelly off against Rotherham, half an hour. Joey Vandenberg after 50 minutes against someone earlier in the season after he just picked up a booking and was looking like he was losing his head. There's a reason for it, invariably. So I'm sure there are many fans who wouldn't be sorry to see the back of him. Who knows? This might be the kick up his backside that he might require to actually go off on a storming run of form. I can't see it personally. I don't like slagging off players, but so far I just don't see what he brings to the club. I don't see what he brings to the side that is any different to what we've already got.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we've talked about the balance of the midfield many times on this show this season, and Swift, Kelly and Much were just overrun, completely overrun, mm-hmm. And shown up by players like Pritchard. I think it was the fifth goal, maybe. I described it on the website as John Swift looked like he'd bounced off him like something out of Pat Sharp's funhouse. Mm-hmm. There was just nobody in there, really, to put that foot in and really G up the side. And you looked across that team and you just said, where are the leaders? Now, Chris Armstrong, I wish we had Chris Armstrong. Chris Gunter wearing the armband again. I asked this question, and I've not looked it up again, Dave, but you can hopefully either correct me on this or say I'm right. Was Chris Gunter the man with the armband when we got thumped at Birmingham? 6-1 in Adkins' final game in charge. Because I remember he was captain.
Was it Gunter or was it Alex Pearce?
No, because I think Clark gave Pearce the armband afterwards when he came in because he tried to take Gunter out of the firing line. Regardless, Chris Gunter for me is not a very good captain. I'm sorry. I think he's a decent right back, even a good right back at times. He has shown me nothing in his time when he has had the armband that he is the type of player to get a reaction out of players when the chips are down.
I tend to agree. He's with a captain, you're looking at an organiser, you're looking at a sort of a message carrier on the pitch, and he doesn't really do anything of those. He's looking for a player to be able to give his teammates a good G-ing up if they need it. All well and good being a captain when the chips are up, but you know, you earn your corn as a captain when the chips are down. And yeah, I just Chris Gunter doesn't strike me as captain material.
And there were no organisers on the pitch. I mean, Liam Moore is okay. He's done very well this season, so I'm not going to completely dig him out for this. But he didn't do very well. Obviously, they conceded 7 goals. But Rhys Oxford's not going to give you the leadership. Tyler Blackett's not going to give you the leadership. Hello, Habsy's a nice guy. But he doesn't strike me as a particular, grab the game by the scruff and drag his team into his goalkeeper. He can only do so much. And then those three we mentioned in midfield, two of them very young, mm-hmm. in Kelly and Swift. And then Jordan Much is a loney, and he's, again, not shown very much at all. And Kermigance does his best. And then you've got another loney in Grabban and Gareth McCleary, who drifts in and out of games regularly. So mm-hmm. as soon as they went behind, admittedly, to what was a very, very soft penalty, Dave.
It was quite a pathetic decision, really, wasn't it? There's nothing there. It's game-changing decision in the first minute. It ultimately has killed us, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
As the first half performance has shown.
And they just never came back. So, as we mentioned, this is a recurring thing now. What does Stam do for the next away game? Because if you wanted a test to see how a team can respond against a very good side, you're not going to do, you can't do a lot worse than Villa, who are on an absolutely storming run of form mm-hmm. at home. Very good side, a lot of established players, very similar to Norwich's squad, really. And with a similar sort of quality that we will hopefully be facing in the playoffs. Now, what does he do? I had this discussion with Ollie. Does he rip up everything he's done away from home this season and try something completely new? Or does he stick with what he's got and say, learn from what happened at the weekend?
I think he doesn't rip it up, but I think he has to change his approach. And we've said this earlier in the season. He's got to be more subtle away from home. He's got to be less open. And if that means just playing a more compact formation with perhaps a second defensive midfielder in there just to shore up and make sure that opposition don't have the opportunities to counter-attack us quite so frequently as they do. But something's got to change, because it's naive to A, set up exactly the same as you would do at home, and B, do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result.
Yeah, I can totally understand. And we've had this debate many times. Go back and listen through the archive. That I understand why he wants his team to learn, and they will learn very important lessons from games like this. And Stam as much has said so. It's a good time to get into his quotes, actually. He said, maybe this is the next stage for the group in terms of becoming better. If it's not working out for us, if a number of the players aren't playing up to the standards we've set, what we can change as a team to make it more difficult for the opposition. what can we change as a team to make it more difficult for the opposition? We knew today's game was going to be a difficult one, but you don't want to lose by this scoreline. We were having a great run, and then this happens. As a team, we try to learn from our mistakes, and if you play a game like this, you could say, it's an off day. That's the easy option. Let's move on to the next one. But we still need to improve, and we need to talk about this one. The mistakes we made, how the opposition played, that's how you improve as a team, how I improve as a manager. As I said every week, for me, he's got it spot on.
Can't disagree.
But it's one thing to say these things and another thing to do them.
Exactly. And you've got to question whether or not we are actually learning. Mm. Because we're continually conceding goals away from home. And he does turn around and say very often, we need to learn from this, we need to learn from this, particularly in the away games. It's not so, we're fine at home, clearly. The record speaks for itself. But we concede a bucket, you know, we conceded more than two goals a game away from home on average.
Yeah. I will give him, as mentioned at the top of the recap, I will give him a slight hall pass because of the injuries. There wasn't an Evans or a Vandenberg to put in the team.
No, this is very true.
And Williams must be dealing with some sort of issue for him not to start that game. Mm-hmm. And obviously a lot of senior defenders, as we mentioned, out. So not a lot of opportunity there. And if they had gone there and played 4-5-1, would it have necessarily worked with that personnel? I don't know. But when those players do come back, we need to see something different, because the big fear here is we go away in the playoffs, especially if we you know, we finish third or fourth, which could very easily happen. We have that away leg first. They get blitzed and just blitzed out the playoffs straight away before we even come home. And that's not a fear. We've just rattled off all of the teams they've been humped by, and most of them are top 10 sides. Mm-hmm. So something very much has to change. Give credit to Norwich as well. I mean, I was invited on to Radio Norfolk on Thursday night for their preview show. And I said to them, you know, you look up and down Norwich's squad, they've got a lot of very talented players. Alex Pritchard, an £8 million player. Cameron Jerome, who always scores against Reading, and did so again. People like Oliveira, who's on court track for, 20-odd goals a season. So this wasn't an
He scored in three of his last four against us.
This wasn't an unexpected defeat for me. I didn't go, oh no, we've lost to Norwich, we're an awful side. It's just a manner. It's just a way. Yeah. And obviously it wasn't helped by the results around us. Everybody else, bar Huddersfield, picking up 3 points. Leeds beat Preston. Sheffield Wednesday picking up a surprise-ish win over Newcastle. And Fulham beat, was it Ipswich at Craven Cottage as well. Yes. So the pressure's back on a little bit. We've still got that 6-point advantage, but any hope we had of holding a bit of a goal difference advantage have gone. So effectively, you know, if they make up that 6 points, that will be enough. So Reading can't afford now to lose on paper more than one game, if mathematically speaking. Although I think Sheffield Wednesday are playing Fulham might change that mathematical formula slightly. But realistically, Dave, 73 points now. Fulham in 7th are on 67. How many points is it going to take, in your opinion, to be 100% safe?
I'd still, looking at the fixtures that we've got and looking at the table, I'd still be disappointed if we didn't reach 80 points. I think we will probably need 78.
Yeah.
Between 78 and 80.
And that would require Fulham to, you know, win 3 games and draw 2 others. And they've got a lot of tough sides. They play Norwich next, and they've got Newcastle as well. Mm-hmm. And Sheffield Wednesday on that last day.
They have a tough run in.
Yeah, so Reading, you know, it's absolutely vital. And Saturday's going to be a difficult one, and we'll talk about it again more in any other business, but the fact that Reading play after everyone else means that pressure really could be on. And the last thing you want is all that pressure being stacked up against you when you play Rotherham in what should be a gimme game. It's when you have those nerves. You think back to the Premier League season. You thought, oh, it's Watford. We'll beat them and get into Europe. Yep. They're rubbish. They've already relegated. And
or more recently, you look back to Sheffield United at home in 2011, 2-0 up, and we lost 3-2.
Yes. Alex McCarthy having a bit of a mare that day, I seem to remember.
Didn't have a great game.
No. So hopefully it won't all come down to that. And this was just a blip. And hopefully we know we've got that extra day of recovery time and a lot of players in the treatment room. Stam's not given too much of an injury update, but considering he said McShane was on the verge of a comeback before the Leeds game, it's slightly concerning that he's not back. But we'll keep you updated with any news that comes out of his news conference as we get it. Anyway, with that out of the way, it's time to move on to some good news off the pitch. At least we think it's good news. Anyway, let's move on to News Bites.
Reading News Bites on the Tarlhurst End podcast.
Dave, for months now, we've been wondering what is going to happen with this proposed takeover by a Chinese consortium. It was originally announced way back in November and was expected to be done before the start of the January transfer window. But it dragged on with silence from virtually all parties, a couple of whispers coming out in the media, but nothing concrete. And now, suddenly, almost out of nowhere, on a very good weekend for good news, might I add, we had a statement from the football club saying that they had received conditional approval from the EFL for the takeover to be completed, with the parties that were originally suggested, Dai Young and Dai Zhuli, leading this group. On the surface, very good news indeed. We've been waiting for news, and this is very positive.
Yep.
The negative, if there is one, and at the moment this is very much paper talk with nothing substantiated, is that the Daily Telegraph are reporting that the fact that the EFL have approved it is one thing, but they claim that the Premier League might try and block it because they're not happy with the pair after their involvement in the blocked bid for Hull that we've all known about. Now, that is very, very important to stress at this paper talk. There is nothing that the Premier League have said, and there is nothing that, obviously, Reading have said. So, on the surface, and for now, I can only see it as a good thing.
Yeah, it adds a little bit of stability, doesn't it? You had the Amsterdam in January almost complaining that there wasn't any secure future, questioning his future himself, insinuating that, you know, he may not want to see the project through if he's not given assurances on the promises that were given. So, you know, if that provides at least some clarity in his mind, then and certainly the players' minds, then yeah, great. And certainly, you can look at it with a little bit, you know, with looking at it with rose-tinted glasses. Yeah, it's good news.
Yeah, and it's very much needed stability, as you say. And the very fact the radio silence was unsettling everybody around the football club, especially when you had those disastrous set of accounts come out as well. It was just a case of everyone was getting antsy. You didn't know the manager was going to stick around. You didn't know which players could stick around. You know, not being overdramatic, we didn't know what was going to be next for the club full stop if the takeover didn't happen. And those fears have unfortunately been sort of backed up by Lady Sassamer, who did an interview with the BBC this week, basically saying that they were struggling to fund the club.
Yeah.
So our fears that we've had over the past few months have again, kind of been justified, if not fortunately now, hopefully put in the past by this takeover. But she said one of the key quotes, and again, you can read much more up on thetylersen.com, but one of the key quotes I've picked out here is, she said, "You know, owning a football club is something like I've never experienced in my entire life. It's a lot of money that has to be spent every month. It's very expensive. And if you don't have very, very deep pockets, then it's not possible. We are struggling, to tell you the truth. I don't know 100%, but we're struggling. Every month we have to spend more money, more money, more money. And there's a point when we couldn't afford it comfortably."
Well, do you know, and it's very, very honourable of Lady Sassamer to come out and say that and be what looks to be brutally honest. But they haven't helped themselves over the last 2.5 to 3 years. You know, they brought the club, and we'll have, you know, every Reading fan should be thankful for them keeping the club out of administration. Wouldn't go so far as to say that, you know, there were sort of death knells on the door. Or what have you.
It was a Bolton-esque scenario, wasn't it? Or Charlton?
Potentially, yes. TSI had left us up a certain creek without a paddle a broken paddle, shall we say.
A brown stream.
So we should always be thankful for them. But at the same time, they've been very naive with their decision-making, with their season. They haven't really had a plan. They've spent money, but they haven't spent money wisely. The club has spent money, but they haven't spent it wisely. Suddenly, the beginning of the summer last year, pretty much towards the end of the season, it was after after Brian McDermott was sacked, we started to see a plan being formulated, and suddenly we find ourselves in a situation where we seem to have a way forward. But in the discussions with Tiger before, there were discussions surrounding the finances, there were points put forward surrounding the fact that we had high earners on the books, and they'd been replaced by not just one player on a lower wage, but multiple players on a wage that was similar to what that high earner was. So the club wasn't, even though we all knew we needed to coin a John Mosaic or to use a John Mosaic phrase, cut our cloth accordingly, but we haven't. And who ultimately is responsible for that? It's the Thai owners.
Yeah.
Haven't helped themselves.
No, I don't think they've been given very good advice by some people as well. You can tell that there's been different voices. Just the muddled up. But the whole Brian McDermott experiment smacks of someone's told him one thing and then someone's decided another thing. We know that there was that power shift from Sasama to Tiger around spring of 2016. But even then, and as much credit as I want to give Tiger for the work he did in the summer, there still seemed that mud. Again, we got almost went back to that muddled kind of thinking in January with some of those signings, that late raft of loan signings and the £10 million loan that was taken. It was almost kind of like, I want to put a project in, but I'm not sure I can afford it. And Lady Sasama again is saying, she admits, I don't know 100%, but it does smack of, they kind of ran out of money to do what they wanted to do and are trying to get by up until they receive that loan. So it is good news. This is very good news. On the surface, we don't know about these people. We don't know a lot about them. We don't know their plans. They've not said anything about what they've got in mind for the football club. So that does remain a great unknown. But from what Sasama said, we know that the Thai owners are almost out of cash. I'm sure not personally out of cash. I'm sure they've got enough to lead their lifestyles. But in terms of supporting a football club, they're at the end of their tenure. The one thing that has caused a bit of controversy among fans is they did say as well that they will be keeping control of the Royal Elm Park project. And some people, we've got a question in the mailbag that I might as well just get to it now. Sort of asking, Andrew Stagg says, your view on the Thai owners, are they asset stripping us, selling the club but keeping the car park and hotel? Are our revenue streams gone?
Well, the club no longer own the car park anyway. They sold the land for Royal Elm Park. I think there was an £11 million
it was a change
entry on the balance sheet. And so that's been sold. So the club don't own it anymore. So, you know, the Thais, clearly it went to the Thais, to the Thai owners, to a different company. And so in terms of selling the football club, they were never going to sell the car park at the same time when we know that they've made their money in property. But lo and behold, what's happened? So,
yeah, I think, again, Tiger was saying that the whole Royal Elm Park project is a way for them to recoup the money they've invested into the club. But at the same point, they were keen to stress that the convention centre that's planned will have some sort of link to the football club, I remember, saying that that was going to be the method that they generate some cash back for the club. So again, I don't know, these things can all change, but there certainly was an element of Royal Elm Park that was designed to help the football club. But I mean, yeah, great. I mean, I'd love the club to retain the land around the stadium as a backup plan, but I mean, this was the cost. Unfortunately, Reading were pushed up against a wall. They were over a barrel, as you mentioned, by TSI, and they had to sell, and this was the deal that they did. You can't say, have they asset stripped us? I don't think so.
No, because we still have the club still owns the stadium. Yeah.
The hotel was never a massive earner anyway.
No. The club still owns Bearwood Lakes.
Yes.
Is it the club that owns it? Yep. So, you know, you can't say they have not asset stripped, but they've sidelined assets and they've maintained an interest.
That's the cost of their involvement in the football club. It's
exactly. And let's face it, you know, the car park, it was hardly a big earner anyway. As far as I'm concerned, it was, how much did we sell car park season tickets for? 180, 200 quid, something like that? How many car parking spaces?
Well, they're still building a multi-storey car park anyway, so presumably they sell permits for that.
Unless, they could do, unless that multi-storey car park is to be used for the residential properties.
I think it was implied that it would be for, because I think, I remember seeing all the mock-up plans, it's got Reading, like, branding across the side, but anyway, it's all unknown.
But like I say, it's not a huge earner for the club. You know, it's there, or it was there, is there.
And if the land was valued at whatever it was transferred on the balance sheet for, 11 million, is 11 million going to, was that ever going to massively save the football club, considering they just lost, what was it, £15 million in one season? So that would have only ever been a short term, and they would have sold it probably to someone who had no love of the club at all if they'd been in that position. So, I wouldn't call them asset strippers at all. I would say that they made a strategic purchase of the football club. I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever. They've not said this, but I think the property was a big part of why they came over in the first place.
Of course it was.
And I said that's the price we've had to pay for the situation that TSI got us in. So, but what do you make of this whole Premier League rumour mongering? Do you think there's any realistic prospect that the Premier League would try and block Reading from being promoted?
No.
Surely making us go through the playoffs is reason enough to keep us out of the Premier League.
No, because it would be a legal wrangle that would go on for months and months and months. And it's, you know, the Premier League aren't exactly unknown to legal wrangles. Let's take a look at Sheffield United and West Ham.
Yes.
Sheffield United were never going to be reinstated into the Premier League.
This is over the Carlos Tevez affair.
Yes, they were never going to be reinstated simply because there was the implications of doing that were far too great when that decision in the courts was made. When was it made? In August, September time that year?
Yeah, 2007.
Season had pretty much already started. And so West Ham kept their place. You might see financial, some kind of financial decision made if it goes to a court. But, you know, I can't believe it will do. You know, the Premier League will set certain conditions. Of course they will. If they're not happy with something, it's, you know, it's Premier League after all. But what those are, nobody knows.
And the kind of message it would send out about the EFL would be pretty disastrous as well, because that would almost say, like, the EFL don't know what they're doing approving these owners. And you can imagine how that would make, you know, the EFL's board and the 72 clubs that are in that league feel if the Premier League is suddenly just going to go out. We don't care what you say. We've got a different set of criteria.
It would be a PR disaster for the Premier League and the EFL, as it was for La Liga when they tried to stop, was it Elche?
I don't know. We need Mark here. He's our La Liga man.
Is he really?
Yes.
They certainly one of the smaller clubs in the Basque region that recently got promoted for the first time to La Liga. There were more than rumours suggesting that they wouldn't be allowed in because they didn't meet the financial criteria of La Liga. In the end, they were promoted. I don't know what the actual implication of that was. The resolution of that was, that was certainly a real possibility.
Yeah, I just do not see it happening. I cannot see the Premier League throwing the entire season into chaos by decreeing it. I mean, the takeover hasn't even fully gone through yet either, so it's not like they can even put down a preemptive ruling. I just do not see it happening. I can see them being very upset with it, but I don't know what they can realistically do about it. I mean, we have seen scenarios where teams have been relegated and denied promotion stuff for financial irregularity. Was it Swindon denied promotion in 91?
Yep. Won the playoffs, didn't they?
Beat Sunderland, I think, maybe.
Something like that. Yeah, where they were denied promotion.
Yeah. So it's not without precedent for a team to be denied promotion, but in this scenario, and with so much money at stake and so many legal ramifications, I personally don't see it happening.
It's not just the legal ramifications either. It's also the logistical ramifications because, you know, back, you know, even 20, 30 years ago, you didn't have so many stakeholders deciding when fixtures were played, what teams were paired up with each other, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to take those into account now.
Yeah.
You certainly don't see the punishments in the same way as well.
Absolutely. Well, it's one we'll very much keep an eye on. And obviously the whole takeover scenario, it's far from a done deal. There's lots of hurdles to be made. And there's lots we still don't know about what the arrangement's going to be going for. But for now, let's celebrate the positive. Let's just embrace the fact that we're getting one step closer to a resolution. And fingers crossed it all turns out for the best. And speaking of good news, it seems that West Ham have moved on from Yapstam, Dave.
Yep, good.
Slavisa Jokanović. The latest man to be rumoured, just a few days after David Wagner. So it seems that they're going after the playoff managers. So Gary Monk and Carlos Carvajal, I'm sure you're next.
Yeah, quite.
So it looks like they've moved on from Yap. Yap saying in his news conference the other week that he had no contact at all from West Ham and he wasn't thinking about that. So fingers crossed they stay away from our manager. They've already nicked one. We don't need to nick another.
Nothing more to add.
And as mentioned, good news for the academies. They're into the semi-final of the Premier League Cup. You might remember it's the competition they won in 2014 by beating Manchester City. They beat Newcastle to set up a semi-final with Norwich, funnily enough. Chance to get some revenge. It will be held at the Medeski Stadium on April the 30th. The winner will play either Portsmouth or Swansea. But it wasn't entirely a great week for them, 20s. They lost to Arsenal. Although it was an Arsenal team containing the likes of Carl
strong.
Jenkinson, Sanogo.
They had some very good players.
Debuchy players, well, I think.
I can't remember it, but I know they had some first team players in there. Some known names.
Yeah, but good news that they made it through. It's nice to see them have a bit of success in the Cup again, and it'd be nice if they get a decent crowd down at the Manstead.
It would be, yes. In fact, I might even go myself.
Good man. Sure, you can tell us all about it. So those are your news bites for this week. Just as well, just to give a quick plug, I know we talked about it last week, but the Star Hall of Fame that was held, if you didn't get a chance to go, please do check out the video we made up on YouTube that captures the event nicely. So you can head over to youtube.com/TylerSend for that. In the meantime, Westy's not here, but if he was, I'm sure he'd be telling you the fact that we've got a giant mailbag because we've been thumped, and that man would be right, because you filled it to the brim. So without further ado, it's mailbag time.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at The Tylehurst End
and facebook.com/TheTylehurstEnd.
Massive thank you, as always, those of you who have chipped into the mailbag via at The Tylehurst End on Twitter, thetylehurstend@gmail.com and facebook.com/TylehurstEnd. If you do want to get a question in for the show, try and use that hashtag TTE podcast on Twitter. Makes it a lot easier to sift through. I know a lot of people respond to things we say and hope it gets on the show, but given the amount of tweets we get, humble brag there, I suppose, it's quite hard to sift through. So if you do use that hashtag, it's got a much better chance of making it into the show. Anyway, little rule, had one suggestion for us for this week's show. He said, I suggest you focus on the positives and quickly retire to the bar.
I think that's what a lot of fans maybe could have done on Saturday. There are some very good pubs in Norwich, to be fair, so you wouldn't have been disappointed.
National commentator Tony Incenzo was very nice. He was at the game and said that it was nice. He's pretty much all of the Reading fans stayed to the very end.
I'm aware of a couple that didn't stay. They left in the first half at 5-0 or whatever, but they probably ended up down the...
It's character building, though, isn't it? It's one of those things you can sort of say in the rendezvous in a few years... Rendezvous? In the jazz cafe in a few years' time.
Or whatever it may be called. Yes. No, exactly, it is. I have rarely left early. I have done it before. So I haven't done it for at least a decade. Older, wiser. I actually make myself sit through all defeats at all times. If I don't like the playoff final, I still stayed, the Swansea playoff final, I stayed until full time, but I actually make sure I get myself to the exit ready so I can still see the game, but ready to go so I don't have to watch opposition fans celebrate in games like that. But yeah, I do make myself sit through every single minute of every single game that I attend now.
It's part of the fan experience, isn't it? You've got to sit through those extreme lows to enjoy the extreme highs.
To enjoy and appreciate the highs. I think there's no point having it all your own way, because ultimately you have absolutely no control over what goes on that football pitch.
Yeah, and the very fact I remember the one time I can remember leaving early, I think it was 96, we lost 2-0 at home to Grimsby on a wet Tuesday night, and it was tipping it down with rain, and we were 2-0 down, and I was with my uncle on the day, and he was like, we're going, and this was about 10 minutes from time, and
95-96,
I think it
might have been. Elm Park.
Yes, it was. And I remember, and it's then when you sit there and you say, we've just drawn with Man United at home in the Premier League. I remember being there. And it gives you that nice perspective. Mm-hmm. Just quickly, we didn't mention it in the recap, but it was an article that was well debated on thetylehurstend.com between John Keane and Ben Brenton about whether refunds should be offered to fans for who went up to Norwich and sat through that. Where do you stand on the whole debate? Very quickly, anyway.
Do you know? I was thinking on Saturday at half time that if ever there was a case for a refund to be given, I think this would probably be it. And it's difficult to appreciate in many circumstances. Difficult to appreciate the thought and feeling that people get unless you've actually been and experienced that sort of ultimate low yourself. And I still came out of that particular episode thinking, no. Because, you expect a bare minimum of effort, that players will put in a bare minimum of effort. And I know what we've said before that the certain players evidently weren't. But, I'm kind of with John on this one, in that where do you draw the line? How do you quantify what a decent, what a refundable performance is in comparison to another? You could go to Carlisle on a Tuesday night and lose 3-0 in the pouring rain on that terrace behind the goal if they ever open it up. Does that not have a shot on target? Is that any worse than going to Oxford on a Tuesday night in the pouring rain?
Rain's the theme here.
just see where I'm going.
Absolutely.
With
it. No, it is difficult. I sort of sympathise with what Ben was saying, and I think he was saying that they shouldn't just arbitrarily hand out refunds to everyone. But what I think that the players should do is make the gesture, not because they have to, or even should have to, but because they want to, I think that they should get together and just say, do you know what? For everyone who travelled on an official coach, we've got all their details. We'll pay for them to travel to the next game. And I think that is something that they could very easily do. I don't think it would end up costing a lot because I think we took, what, 500-600 odd?
Something like that. I think, no, there's something to be said for that. If the players actually went out of the way and did that,
yeah,
and it was, you know, it wasn't a fan demand, but, you know, ultimately, anything can happen in a football match. And if fans are demanding a refund, I think, no. Just no.
No.
If the players do it off their own
absolutely. Backs. Absolutely. No entitlement whatsoever. You pay your money, you take your chances. But I do think that the players, I think Gareth McCleary came out on Twitter and said it was embarrassing and it will never happen again.
Yeah.
But you know what? If you're so confident it's never going to happen again, just stick around in your pocket. I said it will cost, I can't remember what the star coaches were, I think maybe 20 quid for that and say 300 people travelled on that. You're talking between the squads, £6,000.
Yeah.
Between the 18 people in that squad, that is absolutely nothing for Championship players. I just think it's something they could very easily do and it would just be great PR. The club have done it, you know, with subsidising the travel to Manchester United. I remember they laid on, was it Man City?
Man City laid on free coaches, yep.
Yep, so, you know, they don't have to do it. I don't think there's any moral obligation, but I just think it would be a nice gesture. Anyway, back to the mailbag. John Hyde just goes for his thoughts on the game. Would probably sum it up after Saturday. I agree, John. Steve Curtis, Raw Hoops, says, do you think Stan will ring the changes after that? Give players like Mate and Watson a chance? And I know someone followed that up on that, saying people like Rob Dickey as well.
No. It's a simple answer to that. He has his way of playing. Personnel may change in terms of established first team players, but I don't think he has a great deal of option.
Yeah, it depends what the fitness situation is like on Saturday, doesn't it?
I think if this had occurred when we were assured of a playoff place, I think we would certainly see changes. But the fact that we're not assured of it, I don't think we can afford to.
Yeah, and also, while it's nice to say give players like Mate and Watson a chance, we've not really seen that they're going to be a definite upgrade. It's not like we've seen Watson have 10 games earlier this season when Gunter maybe had been injured and go, yeah, we definitely know he's going to improve the team, get him in.
Yeah.
Same with Mate. Neither have really. I mean, Watson had, what, 30-odd minutes on Saturday. Could argue he should have done better for the final goal. So, though somebody else asked, Harry Smith asked, if
the
Chris...
Just to interrupt. The thing, I've seen some tweets and some people criticising, you know, why certain substitutions were made. Let's face it, second half, 6-1 down, we're not going to get it back into that game. You know, particularly after 15 minutes of that, you know, half an hour, we're not going to get 5 goals back. And so why not do it? You know, give Tenai Watson...
Danzel Gravenberch,
give them game time. You know, if you're going to do it, you know, if you're going to, you know, you either do it sort of 3-0 up with 10 minutes to go, 15 minutes to go, or you do it at 6-1 down.
Yeah.
He will have gained an immense amount from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Harry Smith, just on that note, says, if Chris Gunter isn't dropped now, what would he have to do to be dropped? Get injured. I think that's about the only... Get injured or sent off is, I think, the only thing that we'll see Chris Gunter...
Yeah, he is the by far and away the most experienced right-back that we have.
Hmm.
At this stage, and some people may not agree with based on what they've seen, I've seen enough of Tenai Watson, I think Chris Gunter, and particularly at this stage of the season, is best suited for the side at this moment in time.
100%. I know I was critical in the recap about his captaincy and the fact he didn't get the team going, but as far as a right-back's concerned, look, he didn't have a great game on Saturday, but nobody did. I don't think you should be scapegoating him. And again, with 5 games to go in a potential playoff campaign ahead, is this the time to bring Tenai Watson in with no real track record? If this was a scenario where Reading still had people like Sean Cummings and Stephen Kelly on the books, I think you could make much more of a stronger argument.
Yeah, exactly.
But for Tenai Watson, I'm afraid at the moment, it's just too risky. And again, if he then goes out and has a really bad couple of games, you've then got to not only deal with taking him out of the firing line, but putting Chris Gunter back in, who's also had to deal with being dropped.
Exactly.
So,
and this isn't to say that Tenai Watson is a bad player.
No, not at all.
He's shown that he's a very accomplished right-back, particularly for his age. I mean, he's played against Arsenal earlier in the season.
Yeah.
He played 120 minutes against MK Dons when they were dropping.
I think he's a
stones.
Fantastic prospect.
He really is. But at this stage of the season, when you need heads that are experienced, and Chris Gunter is an experienced head, you need those players.
Yeah, and when the pressure's off him and you have people like Vandenberg and McShane in there, he looks much more comfortable. Mm-hmm. So I just don't think he leads a team particularly well. But anyway, that's just my opinion, and I'll stick to it. Dave McCormack says, can we all club together and pay for a cab to get much back to Crystal Palace? Or what happens if we lose Williams? Well, if we lose Danny Williams at this stage in the season, we might be in a bit of trouble considering the rest of the injury list. As far as Jordan Much goes...
Oh, we've made our opinions pretty clear. I mean, I wasn't at the game. I've seen the goals, and I'm absolutely convinced that he could have done better on at least two of them. I'll need to look back at them again. And if I ever see a rerun of the game in full, I'll make a full judgment there at this moment in time.
And again, as we said earlier, I don't think he's irredeemable. I don't think he's a terrible footballer. I just think he's in a position where he didn't come to the club with any sort of form because he wasn't getting played by Palace. And he's not got into a proper rhythm with it. I think he picked up an injury, didn't he, as well? Mm-hmm. He's just not shown what he's good at. And again, in a very similar argument to Chris Gunter, we have seen what Danny Williams and even George Evans and Joey Vandenberg can all do. And I think all three of them should be ahead of him in the pecking order. Mm-hmm. I don't think a midfield of Much, Swift and Kelly, particularly away from home, I think you can probably get away with it at home, especially against, you know, you're playing a Wigan or Rotherham. Mm-hmm. But away at Aston Villa on Saturday, that's just...
It's asking to be overrun.
Absolutely. So, put it this way, based on the evidence so far, I don't think he's getting a permanent deal in the summer.
And what worries me with Villa, we'll get onto it in a minute, obviously, but with them is that they're a big side as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt Everson asks, who was our last successful loan player? It never seems to work out. Andy Griffin
or Zurab because it's Philly. Did we have a lone player in 11-12? Beneka Fobi.
Came in and did okay. Well,
Hayden Mullins.
Hayden Mullins did a good job.
Thomas Sivka was permanent, wasn't he?
Yeah.
12-13, did we have anybody then?
Not that I recall.
Glenn Murray.
Glenn Murray was a very good signing, loan signing. Yep, in what was it? That was at 14-15. I thought Chalobah
was good. Nathan Ake was good.
Was fine. I just think we're slightly burned by the last season and what we're seeing
so far this season.
And even those six loanees, I think in isolation, I think all of them, not all of them, but a lot of them had decent points. I think Ola John was an okay option. If they'd been paying Ola John $2,000 or $5,000 a week, I don't think you would have complained. Mm-hmm. I think there's certainly been successful loanies. So you go back further, people like Ryan Bertrand, fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if you get the right sort of player playing in their strongest position, you're not going to be going far wrong. But certainly if you're going to be getting sort of so-so players that don't really add anything to the squad, or you're going to play them out of position, then you kind of think, what's the point?
Ollie Allen asks, do Quinn and Rackles have future at the club? Both missed out through most of this season through injury.
Yes, Quinn has. It's been a persistent injury with him. But if he can come back and actually start showing some semblance of form, then yes, absolutely, he's an experienced head and a good quality footballer. I think pretty well suited to this style of play.
Absolutely.
Dennis Rackles is just unlucky. He's broken ankle, broken foot, or whatever it was. It's an impact injury. It is what it is. And they're the sort of injuries, broken bones that aren't overly serious are ones that you can come back from. So there's no reason why he shouldn't be able to...
He showed enough in his first 6 months at the club to say that he's got some potential. He's not the finished article yet, but I don't think he's one to write off.
No, exactly.
And I can't imagine he's earning a great deal of money. It's not like he's on 40, 50 grand a week and you want to get him off the wage bill.
He was absolutely the cheap option, wasn't he? Because we were after Connor Washington.
We were, yes.
And we got Dennis Rackles instead. No slight on Dennis Rackles, of course.
So I think both of them have got future at the club. It's just fitness depending. I think if Quinn continues to break down and can't recover, then maybe you look to cut your costs. But I'm not sure when his contract ends.
A 3-year deal, didn't he?
Yeah.
Both McShane and
so you look at it, I mean, nobody's going to buy either of them. So you're probably going to have to either hope they pick up form again, mm-hmm. Or you're just going to have to sit with them for the final season. Andrew Stagg, question we've talked about. Jack Simpson says, why do you think Reading struggle against good teams away from home? With all the goals we conceded, like 7 at Norwich and 3 at Preston. I think we've pretty much covered that. They're just getting overrun.
Yeah, pretty much team setup and personnel. I think we're far too open. We're not as compact as we should be away from home. And it leaves us open.
Also, I don't think we're lethal enough in front of goal. I think our finishing hasn't been clinical enough.
Nope.
You look at the chances that we tend to miss. Norwich, we didn't really have them. But you look at a lot of games like Huddersfield, You have those chances to win the game. Brighton, we had a couple of good chances to win.
Yeah.
Newcastle as well. Even Brentford. Reading have these chances, but they're not as effective as they need to be.
No, exactly. It doesn't help that.
No. So lots of different factors, and hopefully they'll find a way to deal with it. We've answered Harry's question on Chris Gunter. Matt says, I've been very critical of our defence, conceding 20-plus shots in most games, but Sasta exposed how poor a defensive unit this side is. Constantly backing off the attacker. A morning like this was inevitable. Really, really poor. We've got to be better. The Sheffield Wednesday game fooled us. In reality, we should have been dead and buried. Can't afford to concede that many shots. In order to prevent it from happening again, we should stick both Vandenberg and Evans in, crying out for some physicality in the midfield.
It's difficult to argue against that away. You then worry about where exactly the creativity is. But then, and also, in terms of the style of play, with both of those players in there, are they... You know, are we just talking, sort of allowing an opposition side to come onto us all the time? And would it actually solve the problem? I think there's possibly a slightly better balance to be made in terms of defence and attack. But you know, the crux of his point is absolutely spot on.
Reading, though, you could argue Reading now have only got one away game that matters. That's going to be the playoff semi-final, and in that game. Especially if it is a second leg away from home, and Reading have got an advantage at home, I do not care if they stick every destroyer in the team.
That's
go
right.
for yeah. the 0-0.
Yeah, at the moment though, in the league campaign, you're looking at picking up points. If you've got something to hold on, that's when you start thinking about putting enforcers in.
I like that.
Rather than the majority of contestants at Takeshi's Castle.
I think that's the first Takeshi's Castle reference on the podcast in 125 episodes, so well done, Dave.
Cheers.
Mick Day said, where should centre-backs play? The clue's in the name. Ours don't. They push wide and let the midfield drop in the gap, and the fullbacks spend too much time up on the halfway line. It's not bad football, it's risky football, and the spanking finally came.
If you take a look at the majority of clubs who play... possession-based, on-the-floor type of game, they almost, to a team, play split fullbacks. I don't think we're any different in that. I just don't think we're as accomplished at it as what other sides play it. And split fullbacks has been around for probably 6 or 7 years now. You know, you take a look at where, it's the goalkeeping setup, sorry, the goal kick setup, should we say, and you have... you play a back four and you have Liam Moore, who will go to the edge of the area on one side, and McShane or Oxford or whoever else is playing along, so will go on the other side. That's not unusual. And, in a style of play that we have, and you look at the likes of the accomplished clubs like Spurs and Man United under Arsenal, under Alex Ferguson, their fullbacks were constantly pushed forward. Now, even the best Reading side that we've ever seen, Nicky Shorey and Graham Murty, constantly push forward. Relentless attack isn't such a bad thing. Relentless possession football isn't such a bad thing, obviously, provided you go somewhere with it and you utilise the positions that your players are in. But it's not unusual in this day and age.
I do think they are getting caught. That is part of the reason they're getting caught. You look at the amount of goals we've been hit by on the counter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got something to do with it. They're not as good at recovering when they lose possession because they seem to be quite so far advanced.
Yeah, and the Preston goal is the second goal when we lost the ball on the edge of their area, and suddenly Preston had like three players sort of advancing on the halfway line to our penalty area, and only two centre backs, which means ultimately, or two defenders, and ultimately we had seven or eight players ahead of the ball at that point.
Same
in
for
time.
The couple of the Brighton goals as
which
well.
Which is mental.
Yeah, not ideal. So, I'm sure it's something that Stam is looking at and hopefully people can learn from. But anyway, thank you very much for everyone who's got in touch for the mailbag this week. As mentioned, at the Tireless End on Twitter, thetirelessend@gmail.com and facebook.com/Tireless End. We'll roll on now into any other business with two championship games to preview against Aston Villa and Rotherham.
The Tirelessest End podcast. Any other business?
So as I hinted at earlier, Dave, Aston Villa are not the kind of team you want to be running into away from home at the moment. They may be 11th in the table and 15 points behind us, but their form as of late has been exceptional. They've won 7 out of their last 9. They've got 5 successive home wins and haven't conceded a goal in that time either. Jonathan Codger is on a great run of form. And you just look through that team that drew, admittedly, they could only get a draw at Burton. But that is a fearsome looking side.
It's a wash with championship quality, isn't it? Hutton, Chester, Taylor, Baker, Lansbury, Jedinak, Bacuna, Grealish. They've all played in the Premier League. Not necessarily to a particularly high standard in the Premier League, but you know, that is a side that should be miles better than where it is in the division. And should certainly have scored more goals than it has.
They'll be a very fearsome team next season. It's taken Steve Bruce a while to turn it around, but he looks like after 2 or 3 years of that club being sucked in lower and lower, they're finally turning around. And the very fact that they could replace Jonathan Codger with Scott Hogan on Saturday tells you all you need to know. Even the players they didn't use from the bench, Elphick, who won promotion with Bournemouth, Gary Gardner as well. Lots of really good players, and the bookmakers have got this firmly in Villa's favour. They're 4-5 on. The draw is 13-5. Reading a 10-3. Not often you see a team fourth in the league more than 3-1 to win a game.
But you know, that just goes to show the quality in their side and our, you know, pretense to capitulate.
So we've talked a lot about the setup, about what Stan should do, what he might do. How does he approach his game? Does he approach it when a kind of, we've just been hammered, I want something more steady and I don't care if we only come away with a point? Or does he stick to his guns and say, no, we're trying to win this and get 3 points?
I think we try to win it, but we've got to try and win it differently. And I think conceding 7 goals in a game, I don't think he's going to have that midfield again. There will be a change in midfield. There'll probably be a change in defence as well somewhere. But, you know, ultimately, the team shape and the team dynamic won't change. I think the positional play may well start thinking about the number of goals that we're conceding.
Yeah, I'm not overly positive heading into this one. We'll come on to predictions in a minute, but we flip, we do a complete 180 from one of the most informed teams in the division to a historically bad team in the division. Rotherham, they're already relegated, the bottom of the league. They've lost 10 in a row and they've only taken 1 point away from home all season long.
At Ipswich.
Yeah, and you look at that team and you go completely the opposite. And do you know what? In all honesty, I'm struggling to tell you who most of these players are. I know Joe Mattock and Lewis Price. But you got Fisher,
Johnson Clark,
Ajayi, Wood, Newell.
Joe Newell.
Volks, Ford. Did he just play for Millwall? Smallwood. Morris and Danny Ward, who I am familiar with. But that is a very bad side, unfortunately.
Their league position, suggests that.
Is there any chance Reading slip? There's always a chance, but Reading are going to win this game, surely.
You tend to think they would do. With our home record and their away record, yeah, it's as close to a nailed-on home banker as you would possibly get, which are always the ones that are going to end up with.
Looking at that overall, though, 4 points from that, happy?
I'd be more than happy with 4 points from that.
Three the minimum.
Oh, three's the bare minimum.
Yeah, you've got to beat Rotherham. If they fail to beat Rotherham, it really just ramps up the pressure and it just lets everybody else in. Because they go to Forest, a Forest team that have just beat Huddersfield. And they've got Mark Warburton, who's just slowly started to grind out results there as well. So again, that would put a huge amount of pressure going into the Wigan and Burton games. Two teams who've still got stuff to fight for. So let's get into the predictions. As mentioned, nobody got it right against Norwich. Funnily enough, no one predicted a 7-1 defeat. No one even predicted a defeat. So how do you see the Villa game going? You are joint leader on 32 points.
I'm joint leader
Johnny.
On 32 points. We have only ever known defeat at Villa. I fully expect that to continue. I think 3-0.
Wow. Heavy. 10-2 away games. I'm going to be slightly more optimistic, but still predict a defeat. I'm going to go 2-1 for Rotherham.
About turn. 3-0 win.
3-0 win. So there's another 3-0 home win. I'm going to say 3-1.
I'd also like to point out that Rotherham have never even scored a goal at the Medeski, and I think it's 6 appearances.
No, well, there you go. And as you can probably hear from the outside, my cat is now meowing. which probably means that we've been here too long, Dave. We will be back with a show, as mentioned, probably after the Rotherham game, being that on Easter Monday. So stay tuned for that. We're also going to sit down and do a very quick show for the YouTube channel talking about ownership and what makes a good owner. So keep an eye out for that as well. But in the meantime, stay tuned to thetylersen.com. We'll be back, and fingers crossed there, we can raise expectations slightly, because the only way is up after a 7-1 defeat, Dave.
Not according to my prediction.
Yeah, 3-0 is better than 7-1. So there you go. A nice positive note to end on. Anyway, thanks for joining us as always, and go on, you Ars.
Tylehurst End Podcast. By Reading fans, for Reading fans.